countries and regions. Then in the second tier, the AID and several other branches of the State Department are allocated hundreds of millions and now billions of dollars, which they dole out either directly or via the NED and other agencies to a series of ostensibly private U.S. organizations, including the NED and its core groups, that are in reality closely tied to the policymaking establishment and aligned with U.S. foreign policy. And recall that the U.S. State Department exercises oversight authority over all so-called democracy enhancement programs. The boards of directors of these U.S. governmental and quasi-governmental agencies include representatives from the highest levels of the U.S. foreign policy establishment and representatives from the transnational corporate world. The NED, the IRI, the NDI, and so forth are not independent, nonpartisan, disinterested organizations concerned simply with democratic procedure, as they often claim. They are branches of the U.S. state, an integral part of the U.S. power structure and of the foreign policy machinery. Now, in the third tier, these U.S. organizations provide funding, guidance, and political sponsorship to a host of organizations in the intervened country itself, including local political parties and coalitions, trade unions, business councils, media outlets, professional and civic associations, student and women's groups, human rights groups, and so on and so forth. And these local groups brought into the democracy promotion programs are held up in the public international spotlight as independent and as nonpartisan, but in reality, they become integral agents of the transnational agenda. Now, let me clarify that this does not mean that these groups in intervened countries supported by U.S. political intervention are mere dupes or have no autonomy. Not in the least, that's not what I'm suggesting. Rather, on the one hand, there often is a transnational convergence of interests, for instance, elites in Venezuela and their followers who have been receiving massive amounts of money and support, covert and overt, from the United States, have an affinity of interest with the U.S. in overthrowing Chavez because the elites have been displaced from power under Chavez. And secondly, it is vital that organizations and movements receiving U.S. support act autonomously, or this defeats the whole purpose. So U.S. political intervention supports these selected groups and amplifies their voice. What Washington hopes to create through these programs are agents of influence in the official terminology, local leaders with a political and a civic action capacity who are expected to generate ideological conformity, to promote the neoliberal outlook, and to advocate for policies that integrate the intervened country into global capitalism. These agents are further expected to compete with and eclipse more popular-oriented, independent, progressive, or radical groups and individuals who may have a distinct agenda for their country. Literally, there's hundreds, even thousands of examples of this in action, and all of this has been broadly documented. I'll mention just a couple in moving towards a conclusion. Bolivia, for instance, the mass popular movement of indigenous and the poor, has been a remarkable instance of democracy in action, of civil society in action. And that movement has been marginalized and vilified by U.S. foreign policy and by polyarchy promotion. Instead, following the indigenous uprising that deposed Sanchez de Lozada in October of 2003, millions of dollars poured in from the United States to fund and organize discredited traditional parties, compliant indigenous leaders that could counter the more popular ones, and to develop civic organizations under elite control to compete with the more militant social movements. The Office of Transition Initiative spent no less than $11.8 million for these purposes during 2004-2005, and one U.S. embassy cable from La Paz was quite frank about it, and I will quote, that the aim is to help build moderate pro-democratic political parties that can serve as a counterweight to the radical MAS and its successors, or its successors. MAS is Movement Towards Socialism, which has now won the elections and is in power. And in Haiti, the second example, this is a country that has suffered terribly, almost beyond words, from U.S. political intervention. It's a textbook study in what polyarchy promotion is all about. We have the rise of a mass anti-Duvalier and the Lavalas movement from 1985 to 1990, one of the most remarkable democratic movements in the whole history of the Western Hemisphere, and one of the most densely organized civil societies in the entire hemisphere, if not the world. And this has Washington terrified. And so millions of dollars and troops of U.S. consultants and advisors pour in from 1985 and on to fund and prop up a tiny, discredited, corrupt, megalomaniacal elite. And despite this massive intervention, the NED and the AID-supported candidate, Marc Bossin, loses by a landslide to Aristide in 1990. And so how does the U.S. respond? It then moves towards, from 1990 right up until 2004, towards coercive diplomacy, economic pressures, escalating political intervention, and destabilization continuously. This is a classical destabilization script, but now conducted under the banner of promoting democracy, a classic strategy of increasing economic hardships, trying to then turn the population on the basis of these hardships against their elected popular government, and then U.S.-funded groups that are organized by the U.S. come in and mobilize the disaffected population, and this is how it works. It used to work like that under CIA covert operations, like in Chile. Now it's under the banner of democracy promotion. CIA even organizes death squads in Haiti. We see side by side with supposed democracy promotion programs. And so this same decadent elite group, supported since 1990 and receiving this incredible amounts of money and support, achieved through destabilization and subversion what it couldn't achieve through election. To throw polyarchy in the wind now, and in other instances, U.S. teams have attempted to shape and manage under certain circumstances to hijack indigenous political processes and latch them onto transnational political processes, such as recent cases in the Ukraine, Georgia, and elsewhere. Now, the end goal of all of these is to assure the preservation or reconstruction of the elite social order. Economic and political elites tied to the global capitalist order and to the U.S. policymaking apparatus must come to power and must be defended in power. And to conclude this fourth point and then make my concluding statement, it's crucial to stress that polyarchy promotion operations always are only one component of overall U.S. foreign policy, part of a much broader sweeping unitary strategy. So when we talk about polyarchy promotion, we need to see it in the context of overall U.S. policy, including diplomatic undertakings, often coercive diplomacy. For example, nothing the NED does is not coordinated with it overall U.S. foreign policy and the State Department, often including military aggression, often including economic sanctions, blackmail, carrots and sticks. And here the key thing is controlling international financial resources and markets and having U.S. control levers to the global economy, often including CIA propaganda and covert operations, and often including international and multilateralization of these strategies. In Panama from 1988 to 1989, in Nicaragua from 1983 to 1990, we saw the combination of polyarchy promotion programs with military aggression, economic sanctions, coercive diplomacy, CIA action, and all of this resulting in polyarchic outcomes in the installation of neoliberal elites, which was the end goal. And so finally, my fifth point, and I will conclude with this, there's a question, and I really want to emphasize this as a way of ending, that there's a question of the symmetry and the asymmetry of global power relations, of double standards, and of the arrogance of power that I would really like you to consider. As brazen as the question might sound, I want to raise it. What moral authority does the United States have to claim to promote democracy abroad? How would the U.S. government react if other countries, some of which are arguably more democratic than the United States, undertook the types of intervention inside the United States that the U.S. undertakes in their countries? In the United States, it is a felony to accept money abroad for elections. What if I received millions of dollars from Venezuela to oppose Bush in the last elections, to denounce and to organize against the 2000 electoral fraud in Florida and elsewhere? I would be in jail right now. What if the Venezuelan government organized a U.S. referendum to see if we would recall Bush through the referendum? That's the referendum the U.S. has organized in Venezuela. What if I received millions of dollars from Cuba to oppose the invasion and occupation of Iraq? And if I met with the Cuban Charged Affairs in Washington to plan this operation, I would be in jail, as you well know. I would be branded a traitor, an agent of a foreign government, a terrorist. The U.S. provided some $40 million to replace Milosevic with Kostunica in the 2000 Serbian elections. And remember, I am not saying that Milosevic is democratic, but the democracy here has nothing to do with what's going on. The equivalent of $40 million for the U.S. would be giving $200 million, and that's at equivalent purchasing power, so it would actually be much more, to U.S. social movements to promote democracy domestically. No doubt that $200 million or more would have enabled opposition groups in the U.S. to successfully challenge the stolen U.S. elections that same year. So let me just conclude by saying if we want to talk about democracy, we need to start with a single consistent set of principles. Thank you.